Mr. Kupsis.
Yes, Your Honor.
Morning. Your Honor, factually, this case essentially started out with Teresa Orsburn, who is a deputy trustee of Keener Township, writing checks to either herself or her husband, Michael Orsburn, the trustee of Keener Township, in 2001. These checks were written off the Keener Township account, and Ms. Orsburn testified at trial that she deposited them in her husband's DeMott State Bank account. Laura Chambers, who was the vice president of the DeMott State Bank, testified at trial that in 2001, the procedure of the bank was, in regard to municipal checks, that they began to destroy the original checks within 90 days and return copies of the checks to the township. We do concede that several original checks were originally returned to the township, but that this procedure changed throughout the course of this case. These checks were written from 2001 through 2004. Ms. Chambers also testified that while it was the common practice of the bank to mail the checks, that in fact the officials of the township could in fact pick the checks up if in fact they requested to do so. There was no evidence that that had in fact been noted on the file, but the option did exist.
Mr. Kupsis, you represent Michael, am I correct?
That is correct.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars were going through Mr. Orsburn's checking account. He was the only authorized signatory, and I gather that he was an active participant in spending the money. Why wouldn't that alone support the inference that the man knows what's going on here?
Well, Your Honor, the testimony at trial and the testimony that came through Mrs. Orsburn's wife was that while Michael Orsburn was in fact the named individual on the account, and he acknowledged that he did not want his wife's name on the account, the practicality of the matter was that Teresa Orsburn in fact did control the account and did in fact sign the checks on the account. In fact, Teresa Orsburn testified that not only would she write Michael's name on checks that she did not want him to be aware of, but that she was also using ATM deposits of approximately, or taking ATM withdrawals in her name of approximately $300 per day throughout this entire proceeding. I mean, a significant amount of money, $308,000 went through that account in 4 years. We don't dispute that fact. It was a circumstantial case, and it was basically a whole lot of money case. But what, in regard to my, well, in addressing that, the testimony was, yes, Michael's name was on the account. Yes, Michael Orsburn was aware of some of the checks that were written through the account. However, the testimony came out that from a practical standpoint, it was Teresa Orsburn that, in fact, operated that account and was the one that utilized the funds in the account.
Was there an ostrich instruction?
Yes, there was, Your Honor.
Yeah. With respect to the mailings of the bank statements and the checks, weren't those mailings incident to an essential part of the scheme in the sense that either she needed to get the checks back in order to, you know, in order to alter the payee information, or she needed to secrete these checks in order to hide the evidence of the fraud?
Your Honor, in regard to that, again, what actually happened here is nobody ever looked for the checks. At the beginning of the scheme, original checks were returned, and in fact, she was using erasable ink and placing different contractors in on the checks as opposed to her name or Michael Orsburn's name. However, the bank in this case, the Mott State Bank, would have still held on to copies of those checks. Later on in the scheme, the only thing that was returned were copies of the checks, which could not have been altered. But the bottom line is basically Teresa Orsburn took all of these checks and kept them in her trustee's office. They were never provided to anybody. What she was doing was creating her own spreadsheets every month and providing those to the trustee's office. What occurred in 2003 was a new board of trustees was elected, and quite a bit of turmoil occurred over the next year and 3 months when they began asking for these records. And essentially, Your Honor, our position on the mailings is in no way did they further the scheme. They weren't necessary for appearance purposes. One, it wasn't required that they be mailed. They could have picked them up. So it wasn't something that they...
Is there anything that you're saying that wasn't also said in the Schmuck case?
Your Honor, I guess my point in this case was It's sort of like having copies of incriminating photos mailed to you. While problematic and having to be
done. Photos mailed in the Schmuck case also was problematic because it showed the real mileage as opposed to the fake mileage.
But nothing about these checks was actually utilized to conceal the fraud, Your Honor. They were basically hung on to. They were a problem and an imposition that had to be dealt with, and they were hidden
away. That's
exactly
why I asked about Schmuck. The titles were a problem that had to be dealt with by somebody who was rolling back the odometer mileage. And it happened that they were dealt with in a way that sometimes used the mails.
I guess our point, or my point in this, Your Honor, if the checks had been mailed to the Board of Trustees, clearly they would have revealed the fraud. The checks had been mailed to the attorney's office, clearly they would have revealed the fraud. Even furthermore, once the originals stopped being mailed, it wasn't even a situation anymore in which there had to be an alteration made. They were just copies. Furthermore, the bank also held on to those copies.
Yes.
Had the
Thank
bank-
you, Mr. Cupsis.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Connor.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Carrie Connor, and I'm here on behalf of Teresa Orsburn. We come to the court in a slightly different position than Michael Orsburn because Teresa, in this case, in fact, did plead guilty. In fact, pled guilty to every single count in the indictment. But the fact remains that, and without question, that Ms. Orsburn stole over $300,000 over approximately 4 to 5 years. I do think it's an important factual point that in the last year of her theft, she stole the bulk of the money. So in terms of the money coming through the account, actually more money came through in approximately the last year and a couple months than had come through the account in the previous 2 to 3 years. But for our purposes and for Teresa Orsburn, the issues that I've brought before the court have to do exclusively with sentencing, and particularly and primarily with the choice the court made between using United States Sentencing Guidelines Section 2B1.1 and using United States Section 2C1.1 to determine Ms. Orsburn's sentencing guideline calculation. And as this court is well aware, the use of 2C over 2B results in approximately 3 times the sentence under the general fraud statute. In making the choice for the 2C1.1 application, the district court erroneously concluded that, first, that both of those sections, 2B1.1 and 2C1.1, were equally applicable. And secondly, citing to a provision of the guideline that relates to choices within a single guideline, the court concluded that it was required by law to pick the harshest guideline when two were equally applicable.
Well, here's the problem, I guess. Wasn't this both a theft of public funds and a deprivation of honest services? In other words, this wasn't an opportunistic theft. The Orsburns were entrusted with the finances of the township. And so, when they stole money, weren't they also depriving the township citizens not just of their money, but of their, let's call it, trustworthy fiscal management? So it's sort of a double whammy here.
Your Honor, I agree, just as in a case of an abuse of trust enhancement under 2B1.1, that whenever anyone, an employer, a public official, an employee, anyone steals money, there is an abuse of trust involved. However, the government's attempt and the court's agreement that in this case the phrase intangible deprivation of honest services, as it's used under 1346 and as it's used under the guideline, is an overly broad usage of the term. And I discussed that in our briefs quite specifically, and it really goes unresponded by the government. Because just as with an abuse of trust position, for example, a cashier who works at a bank who steals money as she's working as a cashier, she's clearly abused the trust of her employer. But the guidelines tell us the abuse of trust enhancement is designed for something more. It is not merely the idea that an employee can abuse the trust of its employer or that a public official can abuse the trust of its citizenship that makes it an intangible rights case. And I cite the court in making this distinction to the 18 U.S.C. Section 666, which is the statute that makes it illegal for a public official, an employee, a local government agency to steal government funds. The guidelines clearly say in that case that there is a choice between 2B1.1 and 2C1.1 by the sentencing court. However, what is clarified in that appendix to the guidelines is that you use the 2C1.1 when you have something tantamount to a solicitation, a bribery, a quid pro quo kickback, or something to that nature. A public official who steals money they're not entitled to under 666 is punished under 2B1.1 unless you have the additional characteristic of the offense that there is bribery, solicitation, or something of the like involved.
Or theft of honest services.
Yes, I understand that the term theft of honest services is actually included in the 2C1.1 provision.
And why is this not that?
This is not that, because the intangible theft that is referred to is something tantamount to the bribery. And let me take
this. It doesn't have to be bribery.
It doesn't have to be bribery. It could be a kickback. It could be, as the guideline specifically talks about in the cross-reference between 2B1.1 and 2C1.1.
Well, it means pecuniary personal gain.
That is not what the cross-reference says. The cross-reference talks about the application of 2C1.1 in an otherwise 2B1.1 scenario when the individual uses their influence in a corruptive way.
Why doesn't this qualify? It seems to me the classic case. She's appointed by her husband to this deputy trustee position. He's the trustee. I guess there's no nepotism rule in this township.
And she steals money.
And she uses that position of public trust for her own substantial pecuniary personal gain.
Just like, Your Honor, an individual would under 18 U.S.C. Section 666A who steals money for their own purposes or uses it from their own purposes, but there is no solicitation, bribery involved. And under those circumstances, 2B1.1 is clearly the application. And ultimately, the reason for that is when you talk about intangible rights, when you talk about the acceptance of a bribery or a solicitation, a gratuity, or something in the effect, it's more than the monetary value of the loss. 2C1.1 is not simply intended to punish a public official who does something wrong. What it is intending to do is to create a measurable punishment based on the harm that has no monetary value. Intangible rights under 1346, the definitional statute, requires more than the object of simply stealing money. It requires the corruption of the government influence. In this case, Ms. Orsburn stole money. She did not in any way exchange a contract, exchange her influence in any way, or exchange anyone else's influence in any way to obtain that money. It is a straight theft. And using the example of 18 U.S.C. 666A, the guidelines intend that 2B1.1 apply.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Connor. Mr. Van Wormer.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think the critical issue in this case, as Ms. Connor just alluded to, is the 2C1.1, 2B1.1. The problem that I see, though, is Ms. Connor wants to completely eliminate any honest services. This case was a case where we had an elected township official and an appointed, in here, a deputy trustee who stole a lot of money. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, let me tell you what worries me. There is actually a federal statute that's addressed directly to this situation. It's 666.
Yes.
And in fact, the subsection of 666 is A1A. It deals with theft from public entities.
Yes.
That's what went on here. If this case had been prosecuted under 666 A1A, what guideline would apply?
I believe 2C1.1 would apply.
Notwithstanding the fact that the guidelines themselves direct the application of 2B1.1 to A1A subsection? Why would you go to 2C1.1 when the index says 2B1.1?
Well, Your Honor, I haven't studied 666. This was a charging decision that was made. We didn't charge it as a 666.
Let's just deal with the question I'm asking. If this is prosecuted under 666 A1A, what guideline applies? I'm sure it's 2B1.1.
It may well
be. From a public agency.
It may well be.
Any other subsection of 666, one involving bribery, for example, goes to 2C1.1. The guidelines are, I think, as clear as one can imagine, that the difference, if you prosecute under 666, between simple theft, that's 2B, and theft plus bribery, that's 2C. Now, the question I have is, why should things be different if you don't pick the actual statute that's written directly on the defendant's conduct, but pick a generic statute? Why should it change the guideline?
I guess the other thing that enters into, you know, I apologize, but I have to go back to the charging decision. 666 requires that it be a government agency that receives at least $10,000 in funding from federal sources in a year. I'm not sure we had that. We didn't look at that.
You did. The township receives more than $5,000 a year from the government. There isn't a township in America that doesn't.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
So would you deal with my question, which is, assuming that if you prosecute under a statute which reads directly on the conduct, you go to guideline A, is there any reason why choosing the generic mail fraud charge should lead you to a different guideline? The guidelines, as I've always conceived them, are supposed to be real offense sentencing rather than charge offense based. And your position seems to be, we can pick the guideline by choosing the charge, as even though the real offense behavior is not changed. But that's the question I'm asking. Why should charge offense principles determine the guideline rather than real offense principles?
Real offense principles should cover the guidelines, but I guess I'm struggling
right,
to...
Right, but that's what gives me the problem. We know the commission thinks that simple theft, that is theft without bribery, from a public agency is handled under 2B1.1. That's what it's telling us in what it says about 666. And your whole argument is that by choosing a different offense, even though the real offense behavior is unchanged, we can get a different guideline, which leads to a sentence three times as long.
That's not my suggestion. Your suggestion that 666, that a crime could be charged under 666 if it was a simple theft of money,
mm-hmm.
I agree. An individual who, I'm struggling for an
That's
example.
666 A1A is. It deals with embezzlement by public employees.
Okay.
And that's what this is. It's an embezzlement of $300,000 by a public employee.
But I think the difference, Your Honor, respectfully, is the difference between a public employee who perhaps may be a secretary and has access to the public agency's checking account and decides to kite some checks, and an individual who is an elected or appointed public official who's dealing with tax money, and the public depends on that particular individual.
Public depends on every public official, right? Mrs. Orsburn is a bookkeeper. She's a bank teller who embezzles, only she's working for a public agency rather than a bank.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I disagree with that. She ran the office
okay,
virtually.
She's a supervisory bank teller who embezzles. Right? Let me see my problem. There isn't a single case of embezzlement by any embezzler anywhere in the United States that could not be recharacterized as theft of honest services, because the bank hires the teller to do the job honestly, and the teller is doing it dishonestly and depriving the bank of two things, cash and the teller's honest services. So in your view, all of the guidelines that point to 2B1.1 for embezzlement and theft by employees and so on, they're all irrelevant, because any prosecutor who wants to file a mail fraud charge instead can get triple the sentence, without, even though the offense behavior is simple embezzlement. And that's, you see my problem. That seems to me completely inconsistent with the idea that the guidelines are a real offense system, as opposed to prosecutor can choose which charge it is and change the maximum sentence.
I understand your point.
And Mr. Van Wormer, yes, I think that my question sort of leads into that, and it's this, that the point was made that her access to the township books certainly would have supported an abuse of trust enhancement, but it didn't place her on a par with, let us say, a public official like a judge or a prosecuting attorney, as Brother Easterbrook said. She basically was a secretary, a bookkeeper. What is it about her position as deputy trustee that would have supported that enhancement?
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, here's an individual who is, she's an appointed, grant you that, she's an appointed deputy trustee. They're responsible for a budget that runs $600,000 to $800,000 a year. It's tax money. The public, when those persons are put into those public positions, depends on those public officials to carry out their duties honestly and judiciously. And there's actually two losses here. One is the loss of money, which was $308,000. That's easy to calculate. I think the more serious loss is the loss of public trust.
Yeah, you can say that, but that's true of every bank teller. It is true of every bookkeeper at every corporation. Loss of trust is serious, right? We don't like thieves, whether the thieves use a gun or a pen. But it's not clear why that leads us to ignore the guideline, which is actually addressed to thieves, which is 2B1.1.
I think it boils down to a difference. I don't think
5 years in prison, which is roughly what she would get under 2B1.1 for stealing $300,000, is not to be sneezed at.
True.
Here she has 11 and a half years.
I understand it.
Counsel,
you may remember that Conrad Black, who got prosecuted and convicted for stealing tens of millions of dollars, was sentenced to 5 years in prison.
Yes.
There's something wrong when the $300,000 thief gets 12 years and the multi-million dollar thief gets 5 years.
Especially when she does it out of love.
Well, that brings me to perhaps a point that has yet to be discussed in greater detail, which is the fact that husband and wife were in this together.
Yes.
And husband is the elected official.
Yes.
He appoints his wife.
Yes.
She commits this rather significant fraud. With his knowledge and acquiescence and participation, certainly in the spending of the ill-gotten gains. And does that make any difference in the use of the guideline?
You indicated that she devised the scheme. I don't believe that's what the jury found. The jury found that they devised the scheme and they participated
jointly.
Right, she
carried it out.
Yes.
But right, my point is that the import of this prosecution is that husband and wife were in this together. Husband's the elected official.
Right.
And she is the appointee responsible for the books.
Okay.
And the financial affairs of this township. And they participate in this together. She's the one who's actually writing the checks and altering the checks once they're returned from the bank.
Okay.
Does that have any impact on the choice of the appropriate guidelines, or should it?
I don't think
Does that make this different from a lone bookkeeper or secretary who's stealing from the till.
I don't think it's any different other than we have two people involved. Perhaps I'm not understanding the question. I'm sorry.
I think you're not understanding.
Well, I'm sorry.
I was throwing you a lifeline, counsel, and you didn't take it.
Too late.
I'm sorry. I missed it.
That makes this more consistent, does it not, with a theft of honest services?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, where I was going to go is it's no different than having two co-conspirators taking part in a conspiracy or a plan to steal.
There you go.
Thank you. If you have any further questions, I'll be happy to answer. If not, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mr. Cupsis, your time has expired. Anything further, Ms. Connor? Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much to both of you.